I really like your theme of literature as subversion. I even began to understand the fundamentalist urge to burn many of the books that turned your young mind away from absolutism. I assume that absolutism and fundamentalism are two things that you do not envy or respect.
Correct. You assume correct.
Can you pick maybe two or three pieces of literature that really, really subverted your religion? What were the main ones?
You know, it's funny because, I mean, my life has been passionately and deeply involved in literature. And when you say literature, of course, I immediately think of fiction and poetry and the like. But I think reading Bertrand Russell had an enormous, and reading Darwin, reading really more figures like that, philosophers, later on the existentialists, Camus and Sartre.
Well, there are people who'd like to burn those books, too.
Yeah. Well, if there were a papal index, as there one time was, they would be on the papal index list, certainly. Those were writers who really infiltrated. Nietzsche, you know, had a tremendous transformation on my consciousness effect. So it's funny that I immediately, when you ask the question, I think of the philosophers more than I do the poets. And yet, in my book, for example, I write about the importance of so many poets, like Yeats and like Frost, in my development and my thinking. Part of that, of course, came out of just a love of literature and a love of being a literature classroom teacher.
Well, I consider philosophy literature, and one of my favorite courses in college was a course called The Bible as Literature. You write a lot about the Ten Commandments in this book, almost obsessively so, three chapters or more just on the commandments themselves, and then it's a theme throughout the entire book. Are there some commandments that bother or challenge you more than others, and are there some that you would like to edit or reword?
Yeah, like George Carlin, as I pointed out, brought them down to simply two commandments. There is that impulse perhaps in me. I found that the Ten Commandments were important to me because they're the foundation of Mosaic law, and I was raised Jewish, and really Christianity is the stepchild of Judaism, many say. So there you have both of the main Abrahamic religions kind of founded on the Ten Commandments. And the first four really have to do with God. And the first four, many feel, are the most important ones. And if you're doubtful or if you're agnostic about God and God's direct role in your life or just God as a primary creator, then that begins to color your whole association, it seems to me, a relationship with the Ten Commandments. They're fundamentally about believing in God's word. And so if they came from a man who looked like Charlton Heston instead of God, or if they came, you know, simply from whomever was up on Mount Sinai or whomever invented them, then where's the moral authority for them? This became for me a very serious question and still is a serious question.
The one that bothers me the most is honor thy mother and father, to which I would add three words, and thy children. Now, you've raised children. And where do your children fit in? How did you raise them religiously, if you did at all? Obviously, not the same way you were raised yourself in Cleveland.
No, although, you know, you could find some difficulty with that commandment. I happen to feel very strongly that my parents deserve honor. I mean, in fact, I dedicated the book to them and sincerely love my parents, but there are parents who don't deserve honor. So,
yeah,
I mean,
it's a two-way street. It's a two-way street.
And it should be, of course, reciprocal. I raised my children with what I was raised with without all that religious content behind it. I was raised in an ethical framework of believing that one should serve one's community, do good, try to do good. But again, later on, when you begin to sort of figure what is behind that impulse or what should justify it, if not the Ten Commandments, you have to find, if you are a searching person, reasons. And when my kids would say to me, you know, why be good? I had to give them reasons other than I told you so. Or I had to try to help make them thoughtful, and as I hope my wife and I have succeeded in doing, compassionate, decent human beings. But when you start looking for reasons, then the mind can find all kinds of nuances and subtleties and paradoxes that are pretty challenging.
Controversy has arisen, as you know, around Park 51, the Islamic Cultural Center near Ground Zero in New York. How does an agnostic American like yourself respond to this controversy? And do you think that God has anything to do with this, or is it just all politics?
I think it's a lot politics, but I think perhaps God does have something to do with it, or Allah, from the perspective of those who want the cultural center, which also has a place of worship in it, to be there. I think that I'm divided on it because on the one hand, all agnostics are pretty divided about most things, but on the one hand, you've got a place which everybody agrees under our Constitution they have a right to build. But on the other hand, you have the sensitivity of the families and those who are looking at this as hallowed ground. It's difficult sometimes because there's a place that sells alcohol, there's a lap dance place nearby, you know, there are all these things. But who think of it as being a place to give sacred kind of recognition to, it raises some serious moral quandaries for me, apart from religion, apart from God, and even apart from politics. That is, how much do you step on people's feelings if they feel as strongly as they do? And they obviously feel very strongly about that. They shouldn't confuse terrorism done in the name of Islam with the Islamic religion, and I think that's part of the problem too. But I'm certainly compassionate and understanding of their feelings. At the same time, that, like I say, there's no arguing with the right under the Constitution, freedom to do what they want.
How much time do you have, Michael?
I'm supposed to be in a meeting at 12, but we can go a little over.
All right. Okay. All right. All right. Good, good. I want to read you the first sentence of Karen Armstrong's History of God, which I know you've read. I'm sure you've read, and you've had her on the air at least once, I've heard. This sentence blew my mind, incidentally. She said, "In the beginning, human beings created a God who was the first cause of all things and ruler of heaven and earth." Of course, that wasn't an original thought. Father William Schmidt said it in 2012, and many have said it since. You mentioned Nietzsche. And to one degree or another, said that. And Armstrong eventually argues against it. But where do you stand on the question of whether, in the end, God created man in his image or man created God in his image?
Again, one could easily fall back on the I don't know answer. But if I'd have to agree with Voltaire, probably, that, yes, God may have created us in his image, but we did the same. We created God in our image. And Karen Armstrong makes the argument quite sensibly, it seems to me, that we have anthropomorphized God, particularly since the Enlightenment period and the dawn of science, whereas God has become this personal figure, as he was for me, like a father figure. I think that there may be a change in the air, because there are people who are talking about a spirituality which is much more a kind of aggregation rather than this figure who you can look in the mirror and, if you had a white beard, and imagine him up there in the clouds and so forth, he would be. And my intuition tells me, and my good sense tells me, that man is the inventor of the God that we have known through the centuries. That there may have been a prime mover, there may have been a force before the Big Bang. Again, we don't know. We can't prove a negative like the atheists say. But whatever that force may have been, it's not necessarily anything like us. I liken it in my book to trying to imagine what's out there in interstellar space, trying to think about, you know, exobiology, or they call it astrobiology or something. We really can't conceive of it. So we think of it in terms of, if life exists on Jupiter, say, then it's life as we know it. Or it can't, because it doesn't have our kind of atmosphere. But Mars, maybe it can, because they, maybe human life as we know it. Well, there may be human life as we can't imagine it and don't know it. There may be, you know, a creator as we have no conception of, and no beyond our imaginative faculties. We don't know what's beyond our galaxies. We don't know what's beyond the stretch of space.
So where is your theology now? Is it open to challenge, open to reconsideration, evolving, standing still just because you finished the book? It's in print now.
No, the reason that I like to take a stand as an agnostic, and I said that, you know, it's almost trying to be polemical about agnosticism, though I don't like to think of it as a polemical book, is because agnostics are, and I write about what I call the trinity of agnostics, the three agnostics, the great agnostics, T.H. Huxley, who gave us the name agnosticism, and Robert Ingersoll, who was known as the great agnostic, and Bertrand Russell, who may have been both an atheist and an agnostic, depending on what day he got up out of bed. But there's a sense that agnostics are always open, always looking. You know, show me the proof. Give me some empiricism. Give me something that can take my doubt away, and I will welcome it. I'll embrace it. And I'm still, I believe, I use those words advisedly, open to that kind of lightning should it strike, or some kind of reasoning if it's there, or some kind of ocular proof, as Shakespeare puts it in Othello.
A revelation.
If it's a revelation, fine. I welcome it. I think maybe